welcome to Go Men Goats. Probably need a catchphrase at some point, but don't have one yet. Anyway, this is episode 12, and it's a recording of an interview I did on Zoom, actually, with Donnie Campbell and Stephen Pike about the Monroe Round record, which we recorded for the Fort William Film Festival. The quality of the recording is pretty okay. There's a couple of times when things go a bit robotic, but stick with it. I think you can get the gist of the conversation. So we'll get to that in just a minute. I suppose the only other thing to say is thanks very much for some of the comments I've had about the previous episodes. It's been, you know, a great fun project. And if you want to give me any comments, you can go to gomountaingoats.com. And also maybe have a think about what your plans are for the summer. If anyone is thinking of trying some mountain rounds and FKTs, particularly in Le Cabre, I've got an FKT section of the website with top 10 leaderboards I'm trying to put together. So people might have times already that they could send me in to add to the leaderboard, or you might be keen to do some of those runs and get on the leaderboards. So have a think about that. But yeah, let's get on straight into the interview with Donnie and Spike. Good evening and welcome to Fort William Mountain Festival 2021. This is the running night. I'm Finlay Wilde. I'm a runner living in Fort William. And I'm delighted tonight to be talking about the Monroe Round with my two guests, both the current record holder and previous record holder, Donnie Campbell and Stephen Pike. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening, Finlay. Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just ask you first, actually, just to introduce yourselves. Tell us a bit about yourselves. Maybe, Donnie, you go first.
Cool. So, obviously, I'm Donnie. I'm on here because I've ran some Monroes last year, but my background, I grew up in the Isle of Skye. I played shinty from an early age. That was my first sport. Had many a boisterous game with the Fort William team. So played that up to probably Scotland under 17 level, and then joined the Marines at the age of 18. Joined the Marines at the age of 17, and I was in Iraq in 2003 in Operation Telic at the age of 18. Did that for 3.5 years. Left the Marines, went to university to study sports coaching and development. And it's from then I kind of got into kind of trail running and mountain running. A friend at the time suggested I come and do the Scottish Ultra, which was organized by Sandbaggers at the time, which was like a 150-mile MDS multi-stage type race over at Islay Endura. So I did that, I think it was in 2008, 2009, maybe. That's where I kind of fell in love running up and down hills. Before that, I was just basically running to keep fit or running to play football or shinty. So yeah, that's kind of my background into kind of trail running.
Brilliant. Yeah, Spike, you're a well-known fell runner. Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yeah, well, I suppose born opposite end of the British Isles to Donnie. So I'm actually a soft southerner from Essex. So, I didn't really get into running probably into my 30s. So I went off to university and did the usual sports, football, rugby. Probably late 20s, really, when I sort of moved away from university and finding other ways of keeping fit, that I sort of slowly got into running. And then really the area I lived at that point, which was sort of Midlands of England, Staffordshire, not really fell running country. So at that point, it was really just road and cross country, and sort of got quite into that, got quite fit, and discovered it was actually, compared to, I guess, my previous efforts at football and rugby, I was actually okay at it. Got quite keen in sort of running at sort of county level and cross country and things. And it probably wasn't really till sort of late 30s that I suppose sort of interest in just regularly going out and doing road races and stuff sort of started to dwindle, and that then converged, I guess, with my other sort of great love, I suppose, of just going out hill walking. And I'd sort of discovered the Munros and the Highlands of Scotland a few years ago. So I was probably finding I was spending more time out hill walking in Scotland than running training. And it was really, sort of that sort of age, late 30s, that I suppose the two of those sort of converged. And I really started to get into fell running, really. And then sort of the whole sort of series of sort of chance meetings with various people and got encouraged to do some of these longer distance type runs. And a bit like Donny says, it becomes a bit addictive at that point and really gets you, draws you into it. And yeah, and I suppose that's it really. It was, a lot of it was around just adventure and fun and just doing things like that. And that's sort of really, yeah, how I got into it all.
And that probably takes us quite nicely to telling people about what is the Munro Round, because you obviously got the record in 2010. Yeah, what's the idea for those who haven't heard of it?
Shall I go on that one, Donny, or do you want to?
I'll let you go, Spike. You were the pioneer before me.
I mean, to be honest, yeah, it's a difficult one to define, really, because I suppose unlike the sort of the more established rounds like the Bob Graham or the Charlie Ramsay round, there was a where they've got a very set route and a format for doing it and a, you know, a time limit for achieving that 24 hours. I think the Munro round is a bit more sort of flexible, a bit more esoteric in terms of how it's approached. Because I mean, going back through the history, the very first continuous Munro round of someone sort of aiming to set off and complete it in one go was back in 1974 by Hamish Munro, a sort of famous mountaineer and mountain writer. But his attempt really was very, very different, I guess, from, like, you know, sort of what's happened subsequently, and that he just saw it as a big logistical challenge. And I think some a bit of fun to spend one summer doing it. And he spent about 3.5 months over the summer of 1974 doing it, and then subsequently wrote his book. But I was lucky enough to meet him, and he said it was never about doing it as fast as he possibly could. It was about enjoying it and having fun.
You met Hamish Brown.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Shortly after my Munro round in 2010, which is fantastic. He's a lovely bloke. We had a really good chat about it, and from our different perspectives of having had that round. So that was nice. And I think subsequent to that, then various other people sort of started to approach the Munro round, if you like, in their own ways of doing it, but there never really were any set rules. And I guess Hugh Simmons in the late 80s started to plan around, Hugh Simmons being a sort of a very well-known top fella runner of the 1980s. He did a continuous round in 1990 where he basically just set off on foot and ran all the Munros and then carried on with all the other 3,000 footers to the British Isles. And I guess that was probably the first one that really got it on the map of the fell running fraternity, if you like. And then various people after that sort of had their own goes at it. But, you know, there were two Scottish runners, Andrew Johnson and Rory Gibson, a couple of years later did it as a continuous run stroke bike challenge together. And then they brought Hugh Simmons' time down to about 51.5 days. And then in 2000, Charlie Campbell, the Glaswegian postman, he decided he was going to have his go at it. So he similarly did under his own steam type of round. So basically he sort of ran bike and actually swam across from Mull to the mainland. So if you like, he sort of, I guess, set at that point, certainly when I was doing it, he set the record of the time and I guess sort of set the framework of what the rules were. Although I think even now there's not a really set sort of structures to exactly what the rules are, rather than I think you do it under your own steam and start and finish where you like, and as long as you cover all of the whichever the designated Munro peaks are at that time, that's really the rules.
I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling that you're talking about the record coming down from what 112 days or something to like you said 51 days, and then obviously it became even quicker. It's just such a huge, long undertaking. Donny, not to put you on the spot, but do you want to talk about the stats, kind of the overall, don't know if you have, I've got them here if you
don't. Yeah, you're probably best to go to the stats, and I'm not really a stats person. I get asked this all the time, is like, how far did you run? Or, you know, I heard you climbed 14 Everests. It's seemingly the stat that always sticks out there, and I'm like, well, that's what Strava or whatever calculated out. Yeah, but yeah, you probably got more direct stats, but I think it was like 1,000-odd K and 1,000-odd K running, 1,000-odd K cycling, and like, yeah, as I said, about 14 Everest, whatever that works out in meters. But yeah, I think you've got them written down somewhere.
Was it 140,000 meters of ascent?
Yeah.
I don't know if either of you have read, well, Donnie, you probably have, Ali Bevan's book, Broken, about all the records that were getting done done last year. And he says, every journalist's go-to measure of elevation is how many times up Everest from sea level is it?
Yeah.
Which isn't really that relevant, but yeah, 14 Everests.
It's interesting. At least you measured it on Strava, Donnie. My only measure of it ever was a really sort of old-fashioned way with a piece of string and string on a large map gave me a rough estimate, and then just counting contours. So I suspect my estimate of it was never within more than better than about 10 or 20% of what the actual stats really are. But yeah.
And I suppose just for anyone who's maybe been dozing a bit and just woken up, we are talking about doing all 282 Munros, you know, in a continuous journey. Although yeah. That's the number of Munros has changed slightly as the tables have been updated over the years. So I suppose that's another factor maybe coming into your point, Spike, about how there isn't an exact set way of doing it. The goalposts have, I suppose, changed a bit over the years as, you know, there's been small changes to the exact number of Munros.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, certainly when Hugh Simmons and Andrew Johnston and Roy Gibson did them, there was a big, or relatively big, revision of the tables back in about, was it about 94? So I'm not sure they would have done about 277. And then when Charlie did it, it was 284. So I got one knocked it down when it was remeasured and it was under height. So I got 283. And then I think Donnie lost another one in the interim as well to take it down to 282. So yeah, it keeps changing.
And I thought it might be good, Donnie, to get you to just talk us through, like, to give an idea of the size of the days. I mean, obviously every day was different, but like the first few days, like we'll not go through the whole route, but talk us through maybe the first couple of, well, the first day and then maybe the second day to give an idea, because these are absolutely massive days, you know, back to back for over a month.
Cool. So when I put the schedule together, I'll tell you a bit of background on this first. When I was putting my schedule together, fair play to Spikes, like I got his schedule and I first of all thought, okay, I want to do something different. So I looked at the map for ages and tried to do something different, but Spike had the best, most efficient method of traveling, starting on Mull, heading out east through Lagan, out to the eastern Cairngorms, head south and then head up the northwest coast. I tried to do it different ways around, starting in Mull, maybe head south and then up east and then back in. But basically, I copied Spike's schedule to much of it. And basically, I just worked my schedule as in, what can I do on one given day in training? So I know on a training run on a Saturday, I can go out and run 60K with like 5,000 meters of ascent. But probably the following day in training, I'll have off and a couple of easy days, so on. So that's how my schedule kind of came about. It's like, okay, how much can I do in one day physically? And then I didn't really worry about recovering. I just thought, how much can I do in like 12, 15 hours without making double work for myself? So that's how I managed to get a schedule of like 33 days together, roughly. And day one, I was like one of my easier days. So the 2 days that kind of stuck out for me was day three, which was kind of first, it was all the Ben Alder group. I knew from Spike's schedule, he took 2 days to do it, and I was being ambitious and trying to do it in one day. And then also on day 10, I combined two of Spike's day into one day to try and get from Glen Shee over to Blair Athol without overnight off your bivvy. So that was the two biggest days that kind of really stood out for me on my schedule. But the eye-opener on day one was day one that actually took me 14 and a half hours. And I didn't think it would take me that long. I thought it'd be like maybe a 10, 12 hour day. And that was like 14 and a half hours later, I'm getting into Glen Nevis after going from Mull up to Glenfinnan and then doing Gulven and then coming into Glen Nevis to start Ben Nevis on day two. And day two was a straightforward day. It was Ben Nevis over to Versa, over the Loch Abra Traverse and the Aisens. And yeah, that's kind of first couple of days were like that. But then with my schedule, it turned out I was doing like 16-hour days, 14-hour days, 12-hour days, 14-hour days, back-to-back consistently without getting any easier days in. So, yeah, it was pretty tough work in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously, so you started on Mull at Benmore, so then you ran a bit, did you, and then kayaked?
So, yeah, I ran up and down Benmore from basically the shore up the main route and back down, cycled over to Finnish-ish, and then kayaked across to Loch Allen, I think it is. And then, yeah, jumped on my bike, and it was like 100-odd-k cycle up to Glenfinnan, and then biked in Glenfinnan, did the two Munros, biked out, cycled along, biked into Gilwyn, cycled up, cycled back out, and then cycled into the Nevis Range. I did think about joining the Glenfinnan 2 and Gilwyn up, going cross-country, but then I thought it might be more efficient to cycle in and out. That way I'd carry less kit and save the running legs. But yeah, I'm still not sure if that was the right choice on day one or not.
Yeah, I mean, even the just for most people, just to do that day one on the bike would be a massive day. I know I'd need quite a few days off just after that amount of biking, let alone all the running. How does that compare, I suppose, Spike, when you're remembering back to when you did it in 2010, like, because you started, I think, yeah, obviously same place, Benmore first.
Yeah, well, I guess just listening to Donny, it tells me obviously I should have been pushing myself a bit harder, because I didn't bother with, I did all the first bit, Donny, just to
then, and I didn't do my return. Just say that again. Sorry, Spike. I think we lost you a bit there.
That one, and then about 3 weeks later in the round. Sorry, no.
You've gone all pixely.
I was just saying, I think listening to see he was pushing himself a bit harder from day one, because I got as far as when I did the team row, and I just called it a day at that point. Cycled back round to Glen Nevis. So yeah, and I already did, and that was probably for me on day one was already a 14-hour day, I think. So yeah.
Well, he obviously had your schedule, and he had your record to beat.
Yeah. Are you hearing me right?
It's coming and going. Well, I'm sure it'll come back. Donny, you mentioned the Ben Alder day. Was that day three?
Yeah, so that was day three. So that's like 14 Munros. Worked out about like 64K and about 5,500 meters of climbing. That starts in Firset and heads over into Carrara and then over towards Ben Alder and then back over Craig Petrie and back into lagging that way. So yeah, that was like, I did that as my last long run in training, actually, just so I could feel how it was. And yeah, it took me, I think, about 12 hours on a training day, and I think in the Munro round it maybe took me 14 hours. So yeah, it was a big day. But yeah, like, you know, Spike kind of led the way for me to give me the confidence to try for 33 days. You mentioned previously about, obviously, I was trying to break Spike's record. If it wasn't for Spike setting 39 days, would I have gone for 33 days? Would I have been a bit more cautious going off Campbell's schedule? You know, these are the things, like, I knew 39 days was possible. Spike's had run it. So it's like anyone else raising the bar. You just kind of have to shoot a bit lower than them and hopefully you make it.
Yeah. That Ben Alder day, I've not done it as a runner, but that, as a single day, like, looks like it'd be absolutely classic day out. But the thought of just going on and on, actually, you went into some terrible weather after that, didn't you?
Yeah, so day four, traversing North Lagan, so going from Benchalloch all the way over to the Mona Leavens, was actually meant to be an easier day. It was like 55-60k, but only had like under 3,000 meters of climbing. But that coincided with a weather warning of horizontal rain and gale force wind. So, yeah, it was pretty brutal. Like, Yeah, it was one of these days where I actually got some great advice from someone, just say, think like a hill walker. And that's what I had to do. It's like fully like leggings, waterproof tops, waterproof trousers, kind of hood up, jacket on, hats on, and just keep the head down. And yeah, just kind of battled away for about 10 hours and like gale force winds just traversing across North Lagan.
And that might be a good point to ask you about support runners. Like, how often were you running with people? You know, how often were they helping with navigation, carrying stuff?
I think we worked out afterwards. I had a support runner for like, I had company for maybe 64 of the Munros, because obviously this was during COVID lockdown. Well, not COVID lockdown, but just after COVID lockdown. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and it wasn't until July that I knew I was going to be able to attempt it in August. So there wasn't that position. So it was more just who was free on the day. So yeah, I had some days where I had like lots of help. So I had Ali Beaven, who wrote the book Broken, join me for the Cairngorms, and then Holly Page, GB Ultra Runner, joined me for the second half of the Cairngorm day. And then I had some support kind of people in down around the central belt. But then I think there was a week or so I didn't have anyone, which was pretty tough after a week. But yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that affect you? Having so many days on your own and just kind of having to, you obviously had your schedule, but having to just dig in and just get on with it on your own.
It's kind of weird. Like, I enjoy my own company sometimes, and sometimes it's quite nice not having to feel like you need to make small talk and you can just go and join the world. And yeah, you know, you got a route in your mind. You're not having to ask, oh, which way is the quickest line, or you know, that you kind of just like, this is what I'm doing. I'm here by myself. So, but other times it can be a bit lonely. It's quite nice to chat to people. It just takes your mind off it. But maybe you might chat too much, like I did with Spike on Marusk, and make a big mistake. But
what was that mistake?
Spike came to join me towards the end of my Monroe round. I think it would have been around about day 29 or day 30, I think. I can't remember. I think it's day 29. And I wasn't expecting him there, but basically cycled up to Murrisk, which is just on the north road of just near Achnacheen. And it's just a small Monroe. And I met Spikes for the first time. We just, yeah, came up the hill and we were just chatting away all the way up. And if you've done Murrisk, there's a big cairn on the plateau. And I've never done it before. So I got there, touched the cairn, the cloud was down, and came back down. It wasn't until we're halfway down, my wife Rachel texts me saying, like, why haven't you gone to the cairn? I'm like, I have gone to the cairn. There's a big, massive cairn. We went to it. To the point I even Googled Murrisk cairn halfway down the hill, seen the cairn that we touched, went, surely that's the summit. It wasn't until we came down and looked at the maps and realized that I'd missed the summit by like maybe 300-400 meters on the plateau. So I had to go back up.
I have done the hill, but I wouldn't have remembered that there was that sort of big false cairn, and quite a lot of hills are a bit like that. Yeah. That must have been, yeah, gutting to get down. And was that at the end of the day?
No, I still had Fionn Venn to do after that. So it was like a Saturday afternoon. But it was fine. Like, I had company. Spikes graciously came up for the second time.
My attempt to sabotage the round didn't work.
Spike, how did it feel to meet Donnie and then to sort of obviously go back up in those hills? I don't know if you've been up Marusk in between your record and his record.
I haven't, no. It's certainly Marusk is not one of those hills. I mean, it's a nice hill, but it's not one of those hills you would make a beeline to go back for. So now I haven't been up it for 10 years. So that was good because, obviously the first time I'd met Donnie, and apart from we briefly exchanged a couple of emails sort of at the start of the round to wish him luck and stuff. I didn't know too much about Donnie. So yeah, it was good to meet and have a good chat and find out obviously by then I knew he was going extremely well. So yeah, but it was good to meet and just to join him on a couple of hills. That's good.
And were there, I'm just wondering if there were any other attempts in the intervening decade, or is that the sort of first, was Donnie's the first serious attempt you'd heard of?
There had been one, I mean, I think whether others, I don't know, but Dan Duxbury, who's a very good fellow runner based in the Lake District, runs with Ambleside Runners. So he'd had a pretty good go back in 2014. And I think he could well have broken it, but fairly early on in around Ben Sterra at the top of Glen Etive, he had aimed at a bivvy night there, and I think they'd had a bit of an he and his pacer then sort of had a bit of a nightmare night where they'd lost their tent and had to come down. So I think that sort of basically, I think, scuppered it early on in terms of had an extra day or two, and he came sort of fairly battered off the hills, I think, and had to take a day off. But yeah. So certainly there was at least one that I was aware of, that one, yeah.
Okay. And Donnie, going back a bit to logistics, because obviously the whole thing was a piece of logistical masterminding. the camper van and your wife Rachel obviously was your support crew. Like how did that work? And just explain, I suppose, the logistics of your sleeping and your kind of routine when you weren't exercising.
Cool. So with my schedule, the way I worked it is, like I seen obviously Spike, and I also spoke to Dan Duxbury, and I seen that they bivvied out some nights. And my theory was, like, it'd actually be better to do longer days and get back to the van, because then you're going to get better recovery rather than sleeping in a sleeping bag in a boffy. So I was kind of more looking at, like, how much can I do to get back to the van, which is going to be my support vehicle for the 31 days with the motorhome. And again, I know Mark Beaumont, when he cycled around the world, that he actually managed to get by in 5 hours sleep a night. And that's kind of like what I was fearing. I was like, the worst case scenario, as long as I get like 5-6 hours sleep a night, I should be able to keep going. So that was my theory, is like with these big days, like obviously from Glen Shee over to Blair Athol, it ended up being like a 16-hour day. But it meant that I didn't have to carry extra kit. I didn't have to rely on people having sleeping bags, bivvy bags. I didn't have to rely on like dehydrated, rehydrated food in like a stove. I could get back and have some proper recovery. So yeah, so the setup I had was like a motorhome, which my wife was crewing, and she was also the Sherpa for basically dropping bikes off and picking bikes up. So I had like a road bike and a mountain bike. So for the Land Rover track, so like for example, coming out of Ben Ann's, like 10k along a Land Rover track, she had gone up and dropped that mountain bike off for me so I could just cycle out, or vice versa, if I was accessing a hill that had a long cycle in, I'd cycle up it and then drop the bike, and she'd collect and take it back. So she was basically doing bike collects and bike drops, and then cooking my meals for me. So, you know, typical breakfast was like almond butter and toast with jam, and then a cup of tea, and then yeah, evening meals were like pasta, lentil bolognese, that kind of stuff. But yeah, it worked out. I probably averaged about 8 hours sleep a night. And basically when I was in the van, it just meant I had to eat. So literally if I wasn't running and I was in the van, I was eating. And it felt weird at sometimes when I'd been in the van for a few hours because I had a slightly easier day and I'd done it in like 10, 12 hours and I wasn't eating. It felt a bit weird. It felt like I was like not doing something because I should have been eating. But yeah, it wasn't fun. Like people think eat all you want, anything you want. But my best analogy is like having Christmas dinner every night of the week and going to bed like that kind of really full but ill kind of full that you just want to lie on the sofa and just like lie there. That's how much food I was shoveling in because I was having to. But yeah, it's not nice. It's just a chore.
Does that ring bell, Spike?
Yeah, it does. Obviously, I'm a greedy bugger because I actually quite enjoyed the eating large amounts. But yeah, but I do remember, yeah, it's sort of just wake or going to bed just with a really full stomach, and that was probably almost as much as anything what then got you out of bed in the morning, that you'd gone to bed so full you had to empty some of it. Yeah.
How many calories do you think you were going through in a day?
Me, I would probably be going about maybe 7,000 more, like the amount I was consuming, and I lost a bit of weight, you know, so I'd have at least been burning like 7,000-8,000 calories a day.
Yeah, because interesting. I don't know how much you carried on the hill, Donny, but yeah, because my support was a friend of mine from where I was living at the time, a friend called JC, John Clements, who was retired and had agreed to drive the van. So I suppose I had a slightly different dynamic in that he was someone I knew from the pub from sharing the odd pint with, but not someone I knew really well. So him discovering what I could eat and couldn't eat was perhaps part of the adventure, if you like. Yeah. But yeah, we sort of had a bit of a sort of code as to what we would eat, which was, you know, is it going to be a 4 sandwich day, 6 sandwich day, 8 sandwich day? And he would just sort of send me off each morning with this sort of stack of sandwiches as to what it was going to, you know, and that would tell you how big a day it was going to be. Yeah. And I guess on the really big days, I was pretty much filling up a loaf of bread of sandwiches into a rucksack before I set off.
And Donnie, were you eating sandwiches, or were you actually I saw a picture of your massive stock of bars and things.
Yeah, so generally, yeah, I'm not really a sandwich person when I'm running. It was more trek bars and cliff bars with the solid types of food, and then I would have shot blocks for later on in the day, and then I'd maybe have some caffeine gels towards the end, and then I'd be drinking like Active Root, so it's a carbohydrate drink, so it's got like maybe 40 grams of carbohydrates per 500 mils. So, you know, maybe drinking one of them, depending how hot it is. But because it's a powder format, it was great for carrying plenty of calories, because you stuff loads of Active Root into your bag and know you've got loads of calories and carbohydrates. So that's actually quite a good way of saving some weight. But I do reminisce with Spike when you're saying like sandwiches full of, yeah, your bag some mornings would just be weighing a ton. You've got food in every pocket, stuffing it in, cramming it in, and then you think, do I have enough? I better chuck a couple more bars in just in case.
Yeah, because massive long days. I mean, yeah, days that most runners don't go out for that long on one day, but you're obviously back to back in them and in calorie deficit, as you said, because you lost a bit of weight.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly some of the bigger days. I think you're right, Donnie. It's sort of, you weren't entirely sure how hungry you'd feel, because some days you'd be hungrier than others. And I think what you certainly didn't want was sort of to be, I don't know, halfway around Noida or something like that, and sort of getting down to the last bar in your pack and thinking, you've got to keep going for another 6 hours or something with no food left. Yeah. So you tended to carry more food than you probably needed as insurance, I think, or at least I did anyway. Yeah.
Did either of you suffer from sort of problems with nausea to be able to eat, or was the pace sort of slow enough that wasn't, you know, relatively slow enough that wasn't too much of a problem?
For me, I found I was able to eat actually all right. The pace wasn't, if anything, I think the first couple of days I might have been too much and made myself feel nauseous because I was eating too much. But yeah, I found the right level I could eat at, and yeah, never really felt nauseous after maybe the first couple of days when I was like really trying to fuel aggressively, and I was just leaving myself feeling a bit nauseous. But yeah.
Yeah, I think same here. The pace was never that hard that you couldn't sort of find time to pull a sandwich out and just munch it as you jogged along. Found it was fairly easy to keep eating.
I was really interested to talk a bit about the bikes. The bike was really important, getting between peaks and utilizing any road and track you could. How much, I suppose, Donnie first, like how much do you think you maximized using the bikes for, you know, as much as you could, getting Rachel to take it to places where you could use it and et cetera?
Yeah, I maximized, like, I took a very scientific approach to planning all this, as much scientific as possible. So, you know, I was looking for the most efficient route possible. So obviously I looked at spikes and like I did a bit of variation around the central belt, like around Glen Lyon, just to tag in a few more Monroes. But literally, for example, like in Glen Fresh, yeah, I maybe cycled 500 meters of the mountain bike at the start of the day just to get that 500 meters cycling. And, you know, it might have saved me like literally a couple minutes, but it saved my legs. That's how kind of ridiculous I was on the bike. Anything I could possibly cycle, I was probably trying to cycle it. Even to the point, I actually cycled a bit of the Glen Sheeman Rose. So I cycled up towards Carnwell, up the Land Rover tracks, and then just nipped off the bike and got the two either side of Carnwell and Cairn Osta. I kind of pretty much cycled them because I could.
So basically anything to take the strain off the legs, yeah, because you were having to run an awfully long way. and Spike, yourself with the bike, were you a mountain bike, or were you on a road bike on the road and then leaving it?
I did have both with me. I had a mountain bike and a road bike. Probably wasn't quite as scientific as Donny about it, and it partly depended on the road support and who was there at the time, and because at times I didn't want to feel like I'd lean on JC too much in terms of shipping bike into various places, because I knew I was already leaning on him. As favours go, I think he was already doing me a pretty big favour, so I didn't want to push it too hard. A few places I was able to get sort of friends or JC to ferry a bike into one or two places or to fetch it back out again. But yeah, but it was really mainly, I think I used the bike on just the very obvious big road sections were the main bits. And the mountain biking was probably fairly limited. I think sort of cycled in and out to sort of places like Gorvan and one or two other hills like that. But yeah.
And was the bike... Was the bike, did that feel easy on the legs? Could you take it quite easy on the bike, both of you? Or was that, did that add up as well?
I really enjoyed the biking. It was like, because I was dealing with, right and left anterior tibia tendinopathy in the ankles, like cycling was the one of the few things that didn't cause me any pain. And it felt nice at the end of the day just to spin the legs in the bike. So if there was any cycling, I would normally tag it on at the end of the day rather than doing it first thing in the morning. So I actually really enjoyed the cycling, really, because it was just like one of the things that was, found it quite easy. And because you're covering a lot of distance quickly, it feels like you're getting somewhere as well on the bike. So yeah, I enjoyed the cycling.
Yeah, I mean, I put it so, I'm not a natural cyclist. I must admit, I always... If there's an option of going out for a bike ride or a run, I'll always go for a run. So in that sense, yeah, I think I preferred being on my feet. But yeah, I never found the cycling was hard work. It was always at a pace that was quite relaxed. So I never felt like I wanted to hammer my legs on the bike because, yeah, as Donny said earlier, you wanted to save your legs for the hill. So if the bike rides took me a bit longer than they might have done, I was quite happy with that and just spinning the legs over gently, yeah.
Wow. Donny, you mentioned it there. Tell us about that injury, because that happened quite early on, didn't it?
So basically it was day six. Kind of felt it towards the end of day five in Dromochter. My right ankle was getting a bit sore down the front. And then day six, it kind of progressively got worse. And thankfully day six, I was in Aviemore that night. So sports massage and Inverness came out and treated it with some massage and some acupuncture, but it was right anterior tendinopathy in the tendon, so it's just overuse and probably common overuse of running on uneven boggy terrain, which pretty much the majority of the Munro round is. So yeah, that was really painful for about maybe a good week or so. So I remember coming off Ben Ann on day seven, and that's probably most pain I've ever been in coming off Munro. Like every foot hurt, like coming downhill was the worst. And every time I put my right foot down, it was just like bringing tears to my eyes. And I was like, how am I going to get through this? And that was pretty agony. But basically, it just had to do the scientific approach of basically ice, elevation, compression. And I had what's called a recovery pump machine. So it's basically big compression bags for your legs. So I'd sit in that every evening and use this machine. So it basically just compressed legs with air. So it's just basically big air socks that compress the legs and helps flush the fluid and the swelling out. So I use that every night. And also it's kind of weird because I knew Andrew Murray when he ran from John O'Groats to the Sahara Desert. And I knew he had Achilles tendinopathy in the first 2 weeks, but it eventually cleared up. That kind of gave me the confidence to keep trying and keep going, knowing that I might get lucky. Not necessarily textbook, you know, tendinopathy is an overuse injury, you stop, you let it get better. But I knew there's some cases out there that you can actually manage it. And that's pretty much what I tried to do, is just manage it. It never really completely went away, but it got bearable to the point I could manage it and not be in complete agony. Like, I was to the point, like, I really enjoyed the uphills most of the time and hated the downhills, which I'm normally the other way about. And then on day like 17, the left one went exactly the same way, which is obviously probably inevitable because I was favoring my left foot on the downhills after my right one went. And, you know, you just kind of try and firefight and manage it. And then the left went on day 17, but that went quick because day 17 started really nice, no pain in the left-hand side. And by the end of the day, it was completely agony. And then at that point, I'm like, you've got two sore ankles going downhill, which doesn't really help. But again, it was just more kind of managing it. So ice, elevation, literally, if I was in the van, I'd have ice in the legs, even if I was stopping for literally two minutes. You know, if I was having, like coming in, changing over to the bike, and I was like having a cup of tea, I'd have ice on my ankles at any given opportunity. And like, I was sleeping with my legs elevated and stuff. So yeah.
Because I would imagine a lot of people would be, I'm in agony. I know what it's going to be like. It's going to flare up again tomorrow. I need to rest it. That must have been really difficult psychologically to sort of, yeah, like you said, you were managing it, but then to just go out the next day and do another 60, 70K or more.
Yeah, and I suppose from my question I got done is, I guess you've pretty, by the sounds of it, you obviously understood what the injury was, but were you not concerned you were just making it worse and worse and sort of and progressively getting worse? Or what gave you the, because I could, well, it's one thing running through the agony, it's also the psychological knowing you're not making the problem worse every day. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think it's just, like I say, that confidence of knowing Andrew and knowing what he went through on the Scotland, Johnny Roach to the Sahara, where he basically ran down the A9 and on into like France. And I know I've seen his when he ran through Edinburgh, his Achilles were really inflamed and in agony, but I met him in Morocco and he was fine. So I kind of took a bit of confidence from that, and also kind of, you know, cause I persevered, like I was finding ways around it. So obviously after day 7 coming off Ben Ann, where it was in complete agony, the next day was like less downhill. So it was like Mount Keane, which I was able to cycle fairly close to, Loch Nagar, which is fairly flat once you're up, and then you've got one steep downhill, and then Glen Shee again. So them 3 days kind of fell in quite well. There wasn't any massive big downhills, because once you're up high on these days, you're keeping the height, and it's mainly the downhills that would aggravate it, especially the off-trail downhills. So like the really hard kind of boggy downhills where your foot's getting pronated out or inwards. But yeah, I think with something this long, you get used to managing it. It never goes away, but for some reason, your body seems to kind of be able to dull the pain or manage it. But like, you know, they were massive by the end of the Monroe round. Like my tendons were huge, like really red, really inflamed every day on both sides. But I think it gets to the point with tendinopathy, it can't get any worse, really.
Maybe it's inevitable.
You get any medical?
And how have the tendons been since then, Donny, over the last 6 months?
They've been fine. Like obviously they were sore once I stopped, like, well, not sore once I stopped, but as in if I ran like the week after, 2 weeks after, they were a bit nippy. I think it was like maybe 3 weeks after that it was like almost back to normal. I'd be aware of it, but it wasn't sore. And then I broke my ribs and I was out for 6 weeks of running anyway. So by the time I came back from that, they've been fine and not bothered me since.
Maybe it's inevitable that you're going to get some kind of niggle or injury on such a long thing. Did you have a sort of tendonitis thing as well, Spike?
Yeah, I did. I mean, but I think mine pales into the significance of every Donny's. And I think mine was, I realised mine was actually sort of slightly self-inflicted because probably slightly longer into it, but probably about 2 weeks in, I sort of started to feel like, I can't remember which it was, but left or right now, but one of my Achilles has been quite inflamed. Again, I just thought it was put overused, because that's why I've never done sort of these big back, just as Donny did, yeah, going, it started to get pretty uncomfortable. I mean, certainly never to the extent that I was in agony that it was with mine, that I made a bit of a cock up on the shoes because I'd half bigger than I normally did. It was actually the Achilles heel tab was actually slightly on my Achilles. And basically got back to the van at night. I basically took the scissors to the Achilles tab and really chopped the sort of big notch in them. And I found once I'd done that, although I was out of discomfort probably for, yeah, 3 or 4 days, I I'd now understood what the problem was, which I think psychologically the main thing. And then over the course of the next week, it settled down, and pretty much after that, no problems at all. Yeah.
Great. Both of you, but maybe Donnie, we'll go back to Donnie first about what were the highlights of the journey? As if you had to pick out a few days or kind of experiences, what would you say?
Sky, by far the best day. Like, I got it on like a really nice day. Blue skies, cloud coming in and out a wee bit. And I was with a couple of friends on Sky, John Smith and Jordan Young. And I said it in previous interviews, it didn't feel like part of the Monroe round. It's probably one of the few days I didn't really look at my watch that much, think, what time am I going to get off the hill? What time am I going to hit the next Monroe? You know, how long have I got to go? What am I going to eat? I was just literally, I was out enjoying myself, having fun in the coolings, taking in the views, having a chat with friends, just joking about, messing about, really. That was by far the best highlight of the round. Another highlight would have been Neudart. Never done Neudart Monroes, and thankfully I didn't recce them because they're absolutely brutal. It knocked me on my ass, like physically. Like, I came out of that day and I was like, I am completely smashed. So Neudart is like 8 Monroes, 60 odd K with 6,000 meters of ascent, and it is rough, it's rugged, it's remote. And start of the day, it was like really wet, torrential rain, then it dried up mid-morning. So got a wee bit of view, and then in the afternoon, the weather crapped out again, and it went back to like raining and horizontal rain, to the point like I'd planned the day. I'd taken 2 waterproof jackets and like a couple of dry tops, and I went through all of that stuff, just keeping warm up and high, because the weather was that rubbish. And I made a schoolboy error. I've got a pack of head torch and like maybe run the last bit a bit quicker to get off before it went dark. I was like racing to darkness. I was like halfway around, rubbish, I've forgotten my head torch. I'm like trying to calculate how much daylight I've got left, how much terrain have I got to go, and trying to figure out, am I going to make it back? Am I going to be running off the hill using my like torch on my mobile phone kind of thing? But yeah, I made it back just before darkness, thankfully.
Brilliant. And predictably, what any low points particularly? I guess being in agony would be pretty rubbish. But when you had your injury, what would you say was the kind of lowest point?
So day 17 was definitely the lowest point. Kind of going into this, like how I was psychologically prepared for it. So kind of using sports psychology, I visualized the whole Monroe round at the start being miserable. So I visualized being out for like 14 hours a day, been one of the wettest, windiest Scottish summers imaginable. So just been out in horizontal rain all the time, hating every minute of it. I really kind of tried to visualize all that, knowing that, you know, that's worst case scenario, but anything better is going to be a bonus. And I had actually great weather, you know, I had almost near perfect weather as you're going to get in the Scottish weather kind of summer. And then again, also, I knew the crux of most multi-day things like this is like the middle, because you're so far away from the start and so far away from the finish, it's like Groundhog Day. So that's kind of building into around about day 17. And like 3 or 4 days before, I was just like doing big day, big day, big day. And I wasn't seeing any reward for it. I was just getting tireder and tireder and more fatigued. And I couldn't see any light shining on Ben Hope, which was the last Monroe way up in Sutherland. So it was kind of these combination factors, and like it was day 17, so I started at Cruachan and I was traversing all the way over to Glencoe Ski Resort. So basically I was 11 Monroes. And like what kind of set off was my left ankle went. That's the day the left one went. And all I could imagine was the pain I went through on my right-hand side for the next like week, that happening on my left. And I had no easy days. Like in the Eastern Cairn Gorms, the days were slightly easier because once you're up high for most of the day in the Eastern Cairn Gorms and Eastern Monroes. But like I had big day after big day going through Glencoe, Mamores, then on Noidar. So yeah, that's kind of where I kind of went. And then also what set me off the lowest point was I was coming up to Stob Gore, which is second last Munro. And for some reason, I've never done these two Munros. I've done them on a skeeter, but I've never done them running. And like, I thought it was just a wee dip down and then up and then down onto the West Island Way. And I got to Stob Gore and I was just like, oh no, like worst case scenario, like big rocky descent, which is not great for any of your ankles. And then like a big climb back up to Stob Corriora. And then I was just like, oh, this is rubbish. Like to the point I was like, I hate it, not enjoying myself, don't want to do it. Got back to the van on day 17. And I actually said to Rachel, like, I could go home. Like, I'm not enjoying it anymore. Just let's just go home. Not serious, because by that point I was like 3 or 4 days up in the schedule. So in theory, I could take like 2 or 3 days, stay in the Glencoe, rest my ankles, you know, just relax. But that's how I was feeling. But the next day I got up and went up Mail Voody and Crease, and I was meant to go on to Brookelet of Moher and traverse out to Ben Schoolard, but I kind of mixed them days up to try and spend a bit of time on the bikes. I went and did Annahiga, I was about to say Annahmore, Annahiga, and two Munros at Ballyhoolish, because that kind of split up two Munros, cycle. So that kind of helped manage it. These were the kind of things I was trying to think about to manage the injury a bit more. But yeah, that's kind of how I got through day 17. And people ask me, how do you keep going? It's like routine. You know, it's like you have a bad day at work, but you get up the next day and you go to work. And that's what I was doing in the Munro round. I'd get up at 5 a.m., I'd have my breakfast, I'd be running by 6 or walking or crawling by 6. And that's what I did. So
you just had to keep going with it. And
try and refocus, try and break it down to like one Munro at a time, one day at a time, and not try and think about the big picture. Yeah, and just keep putting one foot in front of the other for as far as you could go, for as long as you could go, pretty much was like the mantra. So yeah.
Spike, how about yourself with sort of highs and lows? Anything that sticks out 10 years later is kind of really memorable?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, over 30, 40 days, you're going to get some great days out. And I suppose in my memory, certain days that stick out, I guess, as we were talking before the recording started of this, was with the weather now. When I started much earlier in the year than Donny, it was sort of, I started at the end of April. And I think the winter of 2010 was probably the last big winter we've had with the amount of snow. So there was actually pretty much throughout the round, there was still plenty of pretty large snow patches. But it meant that going around the Cairngorms on probably the first, I think it was on the 2nd of May on the Eastern Cairngorms. It was sort of conditions that would have been fantastic to ski touring. And the only people we saw on that day were people out on skis. Sort of, you know, you can just imagine a sort of running around, a cold easterly wind and in deep snow running around the Cairngorms. That was, yeah. But it actually, with a couple of really good friends, Mike Nelson and Digby. So as we sort of emerged up onto the Cairngorm Plateau, looking up at Ben McDuey, it was, you know, knowing that there was 10, 12 hours ahead of this, it was pretty daunting. But actually, in fact, as the day wore on, it didn't get much colder than that. And the weather stayed clear and we got fantastic sunsets towards the end of the day. And I think probably of all the days, that was the most memorable, a classic day out. So, you know, just classic mountain day out with good friends. And yeah.
And have any low points, have they sort of melted away from your memory?
I think they do. Like most of these, I think we all know, you know, the highs tend to be the things that stick in your memory, and the sort of the painful elements sort of shrink away fairly quickly. So, yeah, as Donny said, I know there were days when you were pretty knackered and think, yeah, this is a grind. But somehow, I think it did become a bit of a routine. It was, as Donny said, yeah, it's like going to work. There wasn't a lot else to think about. You'd get up in the morning, and I mean, you know, normally when you're going up, you sort of look out of the window and think, am I going to go out today or not? Whereas it wasn't really that option. It was, you got up, you got going, and off you went. So yeah, I guess it must have been a grind in the middle, but I don't recall that side of it particularly. And to be honest, I look back and think most days there was something memorable about each day, I think, and yeah, enjoyable.
I would like to ask Donnie about your final push. So you were doing these massive days, you'd scheduled these absolutely huge days, and then you went and put 4 days of your schedule into 48 hours.
Yeah, that kind of snowball, that didn't go to plan.
All the people watching the tracker, the dot watchers, as we call them, were just going mentally. He's keeping going.
Yeah. You know, I meant, Donnie, you said you were going to have you might see how it went when I left you in the Torridons, but yeah.
Yeah, so basically, as I said, I had a schedule for about 33 days, but coming off Noidart, I was completely smashed and broken. And then on the following day, I was meant to do like South Shields. So I was meant to do the Munros on the other side of Kinlochhorn and then going to do South Shields. And the weather was miserable. So the weather was like horizontal rain. And I was completely fatigued. And I knew I was going to have a drop a day somewhere just because I was like running on empty. And like I did Speedy and Miak, I think it is, coming off that. I'm like, I knew I could go and do South Shield Ridge plus the saddle and get into Glen Elg. But I was like, well, what's the point in doing that? Because I would probably have to take a rest day the following day. You know, what's the point in battling the weather? Should I just cut my losses today, stop at Clooney, finish about maybe 2 in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon, have a good rest, and then start again tomorrow and just sit the weather out? So that's kind of what I did. That was my mindset from dropping that day. Was like, I knew a day was coming, I was going to have to drop because it was big day after big day from Noidart, and I was just so fatigued. And I thought, well, I might as well drop a day when the weather's miserable, it's blowing a gale, rather than just trying to battle it. So coming into the last 4 days, I was thinking, how can I make my day back? And so basically it was a Sunday, I did the Torridon Munros, and it's like an easy day. It was like Ben Algain, Leotach and Ben Eyre. So I did them and Rose, and I was done by late afternoon. I had a sports massage, and I was kind of thinking, okay, I had Fisherfields and Anchelic to do in one day, then the following day I was meant to do the Fanax and Ben Wevis. Day after that I was meant to do like Ben Jerry Group, Ben Morrison and Connerville, and then the last day Ben Hope, Ben Kilbrack and Ben Hope. So that's kind of like the 4 day split down. So I thought if I did the Fisherfields and Anchelic in one day, and then do Fanax, Wevis and the Ben Jerry Group on another day, and then Ben Morrison, Connerville, Ben Kilbrack and Ben Hope in the last day, that would get me back onto my 33 day schedule or thereabout. So that's the plan. I started on Monday morning when I headed into the Fisherfields. And going to the Fisherfields, well, I did Sleoch first and then I'm into the Fisherfields. And sapping around the Fisherfields, I was thinking, that's quite a nice day. Like the weather was getting better as the day went on, the views were nice. And I was actually feeling not too bad. So I had like a good afternoon off, good sleep, I had about 10 hours sleep. And like I knew the weather was going to change on the Wednesday. I was like, okay, should I just keep going and do the Fanax? And I was like, so I made a couple of phone calls, see if I could get a better update on when the weather was going to change on the Wednesday. And by that point, I already made my mind up. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go and do the Fanax on Monday night and take it from there. And kind of my mindset by that point was, okay, let's see how much I can get done before the weather breaks on Wednesday. And I knew I had nothing to lose. So basically, if I had to take a day off, I'd still have broken Spikes' record by that point. So I was like, okay, let's just see how far I can push myself physically. And that was more about what the Monroe round was about anyway. It was about seeing how far and how far I could push myself physically and mentally. And it was like, okay, well, I've got to the last 4 days or whatever it was in the Fisherfields, and like, well, let's empty the tank, let's just see what I can do. And I know from previous experiences I've been able to run for like 40 hours straight, like without any sleep. So I was like, okay, let's just see how, if I can. Monday night at the Fanax, which was really great. and then came off the Fanax just just after midnight, I think it was, on the Fannock Estate, cycled out onto the road, and then went on, did Ben Wyvis. I think I summited Ben Wyvis about 4 a.m. or something like that. It was really cold, and then got back to Ben Wyvis, got back to Ben Wyvis car park just before daylight, and I was like, okay, you know, I could have slept, and I was like, well, I know once daylight comes up, you feel more awake. So I was like, okay, I'll wait for daylight, which is about half an hour. So I just laid down for half an hour, just waited for daylight so I'd feel more awake. And then once daylight came up, I cycled up to the Ullapool Road and then went and did Amfokach, and then on to Benjerrick. Thinking, okay, I'll just keep going and see how far I can get. So I did that and came out at Oakhill Bridge after Shaunavet, and went cycled to Benmore Ascent and Conneville. So I did them two, and that was coming into, what day was that, Tuesday evening. And that was, I was getting tired by that point. Like, I was really kind of like getting tired. So that was this Tuesday evening about 6 p.m. I came off Conneville maybe about 6, 7 p.m. And I thought, okay, I'll just have a wee lie down. But I had a friend come and join me for cycling, to cycle like the 80K up to Benkelbrach. And I'm like, if he's come to cycle with me, I can't really keep him waiting while I lie down. So I was like, well, I better just jump on the bike and cycle since he's going to cycle with me. So that's how it ended up. I was like, well, I can't let people that come to cycle with me wait. So I was like, okay, I'll just have some food. Give me like 10 minutes, get me some food together, get myself together and jump on the bike. And that cycle was, yeah, that was pretty brutal, that cycle to come to Benkelbrach. It's like trying to stay on the bike and not run into the verge because you're falling asleep on the bike. So yeah, there's a few times like the bike would start swaying and then you just kind of catch it before you hit the verge. And then, yeah, I got to Benkelbrach about maybe 11 o'clock at night. And yeah, it was pretty much by that point, it's like, okay, let's just keep going. I know I can do it. So did Benkelbrach and then headed on to Ben Hope. And I originally thought I'll wait till sunrise and get some nice footage because I was filming for the Venture Show. So like, I was like, okay, I'll wait. I think I had an hour in the van just sitting drinking tea, waiting for like, I think sunrise would have been just about 5:30. So I was like waiting, but yeah, I kind of started off. I can't remember what time I would have started off for. I think I gave myself an hour or so, but it turned out like the weather was pretty miserable. I knew there wasn't going to be a sunrise, and like with 400 meters to go, I was like, I could finish on a round number. So I was kind of like aiming. So I realized like with 400 meters to go or something like that, I could finish it like on 31 days and 23 hours. And that was like, oh, that'd be cool. That'd be a nice and round number. So I kind of like sprinted the last 400 meters in like 20 minutes and missed it by 2 minutes. And that kind of, that was it really. That was how the final push went ahead. But yeah, it was a big couple of days.
Yeah.
Gee, I don't even know how to put that into context for anyone. Like that 48 hours is like such a massive, like massive ranges, the Fannocks, the Benjerrick group, the Fisherfields, and cycling between them, sleep deprived. It's absolutely massive. But yeah, you did it.
Yeah, you could probably just say like the previous 28 days was training for the last 4 days, really. So I'd just been training for the last 4 days.
So you get to the top of Ben Hope. What time is it about? Is it about midnight?
So Ben Hope would have been 5 a.m. or okay. 2:05 a.m. because I started at 6 in the morning in Oban. So yeah, that's how. So I was planning to be about 5:30 because that would have been sunrise and that would have made some nice shots. But yeah, it wasn't turned out. It was kind of windy, dark, misty, drizzly. So yeah, it's kind of like everything Scottish. So.
And you had, was it about 6 people there or what?
Yeah,
what was
so
like?
Yeah, I had a few people there. So there was Simon Willis, who was cameraman for the Adventure Show. There was someone else from Highland Hill Runners up there, then Rachel and Ali Bevan were on the summit, and then I had a few runners that were coming up with me, but I dropped them when I decided to try and make 23 hours. So basically I think there was maybe about another 5 people that were doing the last minute with me, and then I just like dropped them. I did say at the time I'm going to try and get 23 hours and run this last 400 meters as fast as I can. I have no idea if I like take 4 steps and just end up walking again, but I managed to run it. I have no idea where I got the energy from.
So this is day 31. You've just done 48 hours in a row. and you dropped your support runners.
Yeah.
And you're still pushing to the, right to the very final summit, Cairn.
Yeah, I think that's just my nature. It's just keep pushing myself, like see how far, see how fast I can push it. So like you knew you got the Ben Hope, it's like, let's just empty the tank again. Like there's still stuff in the legs. You know, it's kind of crazy how far you can push yourself physically when you kind of just keep going and just kind of break down the barriers.
What was your first thought when you finished, when you touched that summit, Cairn?
Well, my first thought was, bugger it, I missed it, because that's what was caught on camera. And they couldn't figure out what I'd missed, and it turned out I'd missed it by 2 minutes because I was kind of like trying to make it 23. So the first thought was like, bugger, I missed it. Was the first two words I said when I touched the cairn. But yeah, it was, yeah.
I would imagine the capacity for full celebration at 5 a.m, cold and damp, sleep deprived, was probably, you probably had limited capacity to fully celebrate up there.
It was a weird feeling. I don't know if you felt that, like that, Spike. It was kind of like a sad but happy ending. It was like you were glad it was finished, but then you're also sad it was like an end of, like for me anyway, it was like over 12 months of planning and like such focus for most of the 6 months leading into it and then the whole journey. And you knew that was coming to an end. So it was kind of like a tinge of sadness, but also you were glad to have made it. That's kind of the feeling I had in Ben Hope. It was like, yes, I'm so happy I've made it, but yeah, I'm quite sad that that's it all over now. I don't know if that's how you felt, Spike.
Yeah, I mean, not immediately, because I mean, my finish is a bit different. I had a sort of a nice leisurely get up at the foot of Ben Klibrek and cycle around and strolled up there at 3 p.m. on a nice sunny day. And I think, yeah, we sort of, because of that, we sort of, there was a bottle of champagne opened and we stood around and chatted a bit. And that was nice enough walking down. But I think, yeah, I then sort of stayed up with a couple of friends up at Durness for the next couple of days. And yeah, what I thought was going to be just of, yeah, sort of relax and celebrate and enjoy it, it sort of ends up sort of slightly got anticlimax and almost a bit empty then, because suddenly you're not waking up at 5, 6 a.m. sort of with a purpose in mind. You're sort of, yeah, what do I do now? What's next? So it almost felt a little bit empty, I think. Yeah, it's just like taken away and there's nothing you were really looking forward to then after that.
You'd been so focused on this, yeah, on this challenge for over a month. And then, yeah, suddenly you complete it, it's finished.
Yeah, and I suppose with me as well, yeah, you know, there was, I suppose it was a period of life where I'd sort of, my opportunity to do the round had been because I'd been made redundant, and which was a good thing. You know, it wasn't, you know, a positive in that sense. It gave me the opportunity. But I guess as soon as the sort of focus of the Munro round was finished as well, I sort of was thought, well, I've put this off and been spending all my redundancy money over the last few months. I'm going to have to get back home now and start looking for work. And so there's a little bit also, I suppose, yeah, of reality hits again now after that sort of interlude on the Munro round.
Yeah. And I read that there was something waiting for you, Donnie, on the cairn of Ben Hope.
Yeah, Spike had managed to get a bottle of Jura up there for me. So yeah, that kind of warmed me up at 5 a.m. I wasn't sure that was the best recovery drink to have after 48 hours of Munro bagging. But yeah, I did have a wee dram up there. Definitely warmed the cockles up.
And then, yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Was that continuing a tradition, Spike?
It was, yeah, no, because exactly the same had happened to me. So when I got to the summit cairn at Ben Hope, there was someone discovered a package that Charlie Campbell had gone up there a few days previously and left a bottle of whiskey. So yeah, so I thought, yeah, there's not too many rules and traditions with the Munro round, but I thought that's probably quite a nice one to keep up. So yeah, the only disappointment I think for Donny was it was a bottle of Jura and not a Sky whiskey, but I'm afraid.
There was no disappointment, Spike. It went down nicely. Okay. Not at 5 a.m., mind you, but it did go down nicely.
Maybe the Jura is a suggestion of like the Corbett round, maybe it should be next on the radar.
Yeah, I'll leave that one to Spike.
Yeah, I might leave that. I'll leave that with Manny Gorman. I think he's still got that record, hasn't he?
It's absolutely brilliant to chat about this, both of you. I mean, just sounds like, you know, what really comes across is just these amazing personal experiences, like, you know, over a month in the hills. Yeah, just such a huge achievement. It's been really cool finding out a bit more about it, and you know, you both of your love of the memory, well, love of doing it, love of the, you know, the memory of it, you know, has totally shone through. Thanks really much for talking to us.
Thanks for having us on. It's great.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It's been really good talking to you. And as you say, there are, ultimately, when all the pain's gone, it's the fantastic memories that you remember, and getting opportunities to relive those is great. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Right. Yeah, I think we'll end it there. I will just sign off. Thanks very much. Fort William Mountain Festival. I'll put this on my podcast, Go Mountain Goats, as well. And yeah, cheers, everyone.